Playing a non-constructive role, there'll be a price to pay. Let's see here. Mark.
President, are you considering a plan to cut corporate taxes? Do you believe America's corporations are not making enough money these days?
Actually, we had an interesting discussion on this subject. And if you read carefully the penetrating reporter by the financial reporter, or kind of like semi-financial reporter, you'll find that it was I was talking about an idea that has begun to surface as a result of meetings being held at the Treasury Department. And the whole reason to look at corporate rates is to determine whether or not they make us less competitive in a global economy. And if so, in other words, if the conclusion is that our tax structure makes it harder for businesses to compete, therefore making it harder for people to find work over time, then we need to address the competitive imbalance in our code. I also made it clear that we're at the very early stages of discussion, and that in my own judgment, anything that would be submitted to Congress, if submitted at all, would have to be revenue neutral. And therefore, what we'd really be talking about is a simplification of a very complex tax code that might be able to lower rates and at the same time simplify the code, which is like shorthand for certain deductions would be taken away. There were certain tax preferences in the code. My view all along has been that the more simple the code, the better, whether it be in the individual income tax side or the corporate tax side. However, I would readily concede to you this is a difficult issue because the reason there's tax preferences in the first place are there are powerful interests that have worked to get the preference in the code. And as I remarked to the distinguished group of writers I was talking to yesterday, it's much easier to get something in the code than get it out of the code. But I do think it's in the interest to constantly evaluate, our competitive advantages and disadvantages. And what Hank Paulson told me was that there's a lot of folks who really believe the tax code creates a competitive disadvantage, and therefore it's certainly worth looking at.
On the subject of tax preferences, what about carried interest? Do you think that taxing those at capital gains rates is fair? A lot of people think it's not.
What ends up happening is in trying to deal with one particular aspect of partnerships is that you end up affecting all partnerships, and partnerships are an important vehicle to encourage investment and capital flows. They've been important vehicles to encourage the entrepreneurial spirit. In other words, small businesses have been organized as limited partnerships. So we're very, very hesitant about trying to target one aspect of limited partnerships for fear of the spillover it'll have in affecting small business growth, and so we don't support that. Anne?
You've been clear about saying that you will veto overspending by Congress when they come back next month to do appropriations bills. You've also been clear you don't want to raise taxes. Can you do justice to the kind of programs the government needs for bridges, for housing, and also continue to spend as much as you do with the war in Iraq?
One can meet priorities if they set priorities. The problem in Congress is they have trouble actually focusing on priorities. Appropriators take their title seriously, and they all feel like they got to appropriate, which means there's a myriad of priorities. And so what the role of the president seems to me is to help Congress focus on that which is important. We have a debate over that, which is important, of course, but one thing is that we shouldn't have a debate over is whether or not it's important to fund our troops in this war against radicals, extremists, the war on terror. And I think we'll be able to get that kind of cooperation. I would hope that they would get the defense bill to my desk as quickly as possible. Part of my concerns, of course, is that there's different sets of priorities in both bodies, and it seems like to me that the Congress needs to come together solve their differences first, and then bring them to the White House and see if we can find accommodation. I have proven in the past, though, Ann, that one is able to set priorities, keep taxes low, grow the economy, and reduce the deficit. words, we have cut taxes and causing economic growth, which caused there to be, this year alone, $187 billion more tax dollars coming into the Treasury. The deficit is reduced to 1.5% of GDP, which on a 40-year historical average is very low, or is low, below the average. And we've proven that you can set priorities and meet obligations, and so the Congress needs to learn to do that itself.
And that's confident that you can continue to sustain the kind of level of spending that you've invested in Iraq?
I would certainly hope so, because when you say sustain the level of spending, you're mainly talking about making sure our troops have what it takes to do the job we've asked them to do. And I know there's a lot of members who don't agree with the decisions I made. I would certainly hope they would agree, however, that once someone's in combat or in harm's way, that they get the full support of the federal government. That's exactly what their families expect, and that's what the Commander-in-Chief expects as well.
Mr. President, I wanted to ask you about accountability. You're a big believer in it. You've talked about it with regard to the public schools. But given the performance of Iraqi leaders, given your decision to commute the sentence of Louis Libby, you've also stood by the Attorney General recently. There have been a lot of questions about your commitment to accountability. And I'm wondering if you could give the American people some clear examples of how you've held people accountable during your presidency.
Louis Libby was held accountable. He was declared guilty by a jury, and he paid a high price for it. Al Gonzalez, implicit in your questions is that Al Gonzalez did something wrong. I haven't seen Congress say he's done anything wrong. As a matter of fact, I believe, David, we're watching a political exercise. I mean, this is a man who... He's testified. He sent thousands of papers up there. There's no proof of wrong. Why would I hold somebody accountable who has done nothing wrong? I mean, I think that's a typical Washington, D.C. assumption, not to be accusatory. I know you're a kind, open-minded fellow. But you suggested holding the Attorney General accountable for something he did wrong. And matter of fact, I would hope Congress would become more prone to deliver pieces of legislation that matter as opposed to being the investigative body. I mean, there have been over 600 different hearings, and yet they're struggling with getting appropriations bills to my desk.
Given the decision to commute the sentence of Libby, given the performance of Iraqi leaders, is it fair for people to ask questions about your commitment to accountability?
I would hope people would say that that I am deliberate in my decision making. I think about all aspects of the decisions I make, and I'm a fair person. And back to Iraq, it's no question there's haven't made as much progress as I would have hoped. But I also recognize how difficult the task is. And I repeat to you, the fundamental question is, does it matter whether or not there is a self-governing entity that's an ally in the war on terror in Iraq? Does it matter? Does it matter to, a guy living in Crawford, Texas? Does it matter to your children? As you know from these press conferences, and I have come to the conclusion that it does matter. And it does matter because enemies that would like to do harm to the American people would be emboldened by failure. I recognize there's a debate here in America as to whether or not failure in Iraq would cause there to be more danger here in America. I strongly believe that's the case. It matters if the United States does not believe in the universality of freedom. It matters to the security of people here at home if we don't work to change the conditions that caused 19 kids to be lured onto airplanes to come and murder our citizens. So the first question one has to ask on Iraq is it worth it? I could not send a mother's child into combat if I did not believe it was necessary for our short-term and long-term security to succeed in Iraq. Once you come to the conclusion that it's worth it, then the question you must ask is, how difficult is the task of a young democracy emerging those who study the Articles of Confederation would recognize that there are difficult moments in young democracies emerging, particularly after, in this case, tyrannical rule. That's not to say that, Dave, we shouldn't be pushing hard for all opportunities for reconciliation. But for those of us who believe it's worth it, we'll see progress. For those who believe it's not worth it, there is no progress. And that's going to be the interesting debate. And what it's going to come down to is whether or not the United States should be in Iraq and in the region in a position to enable societies to begin to, you know, embrace liberty for the long term. This is an ideological struggle. Now, I recognize some don't view it as an ideological struggle, but I firmly believe it is an ideological struggle. And I believe it's a struggle between the forces of moderation and reasonableness and good and the forces of murder and intolerance. And what has made the stakes so high is that those forces of murder and intolerance have shown they have the capacity to murder innocent people in our own country. And so I put that in the context of accountability. In the case of Iraq, it's a lot more complicated than just the passage of four laws, even though I would hope they would get the four laws passed. But again, I would repeat, the threshold question, does it matter? Does it matter to our security here at home? And the answer is absolutely it does. It does. And then the second question really for a lot of Americans is, can we succeed? And in my mind, the answer to that is absolutely, not only we must succeed, we can succeed. Listen, thank you all for your time. Appreciate it.
President Bush winding up a news conference at the Brady Briefing Room at the White House. You're listening to live coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, along with senior Washington editor Ron Elving and senior foreign editor Lauren Jenkins. A subdued President Bush began, as expected, with an opening statement on Education and Competitiveness Act, which is going to spend $33 billion, a little bit more, over the next 3 years to improve education on math, science, technology, engineering, that sort of thing. He's asked about whether he would approve a 5-cent gas tax to pay for repairs on many bridges across the country, which might need it following the disaster in Minneapolis last week. And he said no, he would not support a gas tax, but would look into the report when the Secretary of Transportation delivers it. Asked about General Musharraf, the President of Pakistan, and the state of emergency that he may declare. He said he has not seen any evidence that the President of Pakistan is prepared to announce that, and that the most important thing is free and fair elections in Pakistan. He was asked about the investigations into the death of Pat Tillman, the former NFL football player who died by a friendly fire in Afghanistan. There have been any number of investigations by the U.S. Army, none of which have satisfied Sergeant Tillman's family, and said he would work hard to figure out what's going on, understands the family's frustrations. The president was asked about whether he would be able to meet his stated goal to close Guantanamo Bay, the prison where many detainees are still held, and said he won't predict on Guantanamo Bay itself. It's not so easy, he said, to get rid of these people. Some countries don't want them back. Certainly, he said, pointed to a vote in the United States Senate, which suggested the U.S. Senate does not want people released into this country. Then he was asked about an idea that's been floated around about corporate tax cuts. Does he believe corporations are not making enough money? He said this has just been floated as an idea. He related it to competitiveness and said that if it does, he didn't say he planned to, but if it is proposed, it would be revenue neutral, that there would be, in other words, cuts in other parts of the budget or revisions of the tax code that would make that revenue neutral. And finally, he was asked about the lack of political progress in Iraq, and said, frustrating, but this is a young democracy working hard, understands the questions. Basically, overall, on the repeated questions about Iraq, he said the first question Americans have to ask themselves is this worth it? He says unquestionably it is, and that the second question is, will this then be redounding on Americans if there's a precipitous pullout of American forces? And he said, I deeply believe that it would. Lauren Jenkins, a lot of questions about the inability of the Maliki government in Iraq to meet the political goals. The president said, my statement of the middle of July indicated they'd met about half their benchmarks. Well, that report actually didn't say they'd met half the benchmarks. He made good progress on half the benchmarks. And again, that government is going off on vacation now.
Absolutely. The benchmark question is the same that we've been facing ever since it was first raised at the beginning of the year. They have not met any of the major benchmarks set, political benchmarks, towards reconciliation between Shia and Sunni. That's the oil sharing, revenue sharing bill from oil that has to do with softening the de-Baathification to allow many former Baath ministers to take positions in the government. It involves holding provincial elections and finding a way to give power to the people in the provinces. Basically, the government has failed to meet any of these objectives.
And as you listen to the president's discussion of what he expects to hear from General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker come September when they report to Congress, are we getting any indication of where this may be headed?
Well, I think the theme we've been hearing is there's military success on the ground because of the surge and not enough progress politically. I think that's what we'll hear in September, that there's reason to continue this because some signs of success have been recorded. The government needs more time to pull itself together. The real question is this government able to pull itself together? It's already lost half its cabinet ministers have resigned. It's basically, though the president says it's functioning, the evidence in Baghdad is that it's non-functioning.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to you, Ron Elving, and to talk about the legislative front. The president took several shots at Congress on its inability to prioritize, its inability to spend enough time on legislation as opposed to investigations of his government. He was asked a question about accountability and whether he holds anybody in his government accountable for mistakes of the past. He was asked specifically about Louis Libby.
Yes, that question came from David Green, the NPR White House correspondent attending this news conference. And the question was broadly stated in the sense of, if you look at the Louis Libby case, if you look at, say, Alberto Gonzalez, for example, or if you look at the conduct of the war and many things that have gone wrong, what are the examples of people who have been asked to pay a price for this within the president's own government? The president went to the Libby case and said, well, he was found guilty by a jury and had to pay a big fine. Of course, he didn't have to go to jail because the president commuted his sentence. The president didn't mention that. He also got a little exercised, and this was a rare moment in this news conference, which was otherwise notably low-key. The president was so low-key that he already seemed to be in vacation mode. At one point, he said, we're getting into a relaxed period mm-hmm. here, and certainly he seemed to be. But he did get a little bit of a rise when Alberto Gonzalez came up. And at that point, he said, you know, Congress just keeps investigating and investigating, and they're spending all this time investigating. They've had all these hearings that are probes into my administration, but they haven't gotten their appropriations bills done. I suspect the president realizes that those are two completely separate processes and that the people who have been investigating are not the appropriations committees and that those two things do not represent a competition for Congress's time.
Mm-hmm. He was also asked about volatility on the markets, which is many relate to the problem of subprime lending, and asked if he was concerned with whether he thought it was going to be a soft landing or whether the housing market was going to continue dropping. And indeed, the financial markets are down sharply again this morning, just at last glance, down about Dow Jones average down about 100 points.
The Dow started out way low today because one particular large fund declared that they were not able to calculate the value of several of their funds, and that being because they were overly exposed to subprime mortgages. It's going to take some time for the subprime mortgage crisis or mini crisis or whatever it turns out to be is fully shaken out. But the president has been at some pains to reassure people that he doesn't see this as a big long-term deal. There have been some bad loan practices. There have been some loans made that shouldn't have made, that will be painful, that some people will suffer, but that it doesn't need to disrupt the economy as a whole or the markets over the long term. He did say that he did not believe in bailing out those individual cases of either funds or even borrowers who have either ill-advised or not having read the contract, taken on contracts they cannot support, and he doesn't believe in bailing anybody out with federal money.
Dow Jones average, by the way, down about 125 points, just as we look at that. But he was also asked, he says the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, unemployment and inflation are low. He said growth continues. He said the American economy is the envy of the world. We have to make sure that we continue to work to do that, and called for greater transparency on the kinds of loans that people sign. He says that they may be unaware, and this is presumably a reference to the adjustable rate mortgages that some people signed that will then tick higher as interest rates go up. So let me turn to Pakistan. Lauren Jenkins, General Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, is thought to be thinking about the declaration of a state of emergency. There's been rising violence in that country, opposition to him, and indeed an entire campaign underway that where he's being, I guess, humiliated is not too strong a word, by the chief of the Supreme Court, who he tried to oust.
Indeed, indeed. There's a rising crisis in Pakistan. Musharraf is facing major dissent around the country. There was talk, he met with all of his top security people today about, there was talk about maybe declaring a state of emergency, although a cabinet minister came out later and said that it's not on the cards. That would have deferred the elections. Everything is building up towards an election. Musharraf is trying to run for a third time as president while maintaining his role as commander-in-chief of the military. And he's having trouble all around the country. There's great unrest in the provinces bordering Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda is supposed to be, and certainly Taliban leaders are. He's got the middle class, the legal profession against him, he's in trouble.
Hmm. The president was asked about a statement he made at a recent news conference with President Karzai of Afghanistan about if there was accurate, actionable intelligence about al-Qaeda or Taliban leaders in Pakistan, if General Musharraf refused to allow the United States to act, would it act unilaterally? These questions come up, of course, in the Democratic presidential campaign as well. The president said at his news conference with President Karzai, we would get the job done. Who does we mean, the president was asked?
Well, the president indicated it would imply Musharraf and the U.S. forces acting together. But this is a very sensitive question in Pakistan, and one, in fact, that gave rise to a lot of the rumors that he would declare a state of emergency, because the people in Pakistan have been so outraged at the idea that the U.S. would unilaterally might invade or attack provinces in Pakistan in its search for al-Qaeda leaders and Taliban leaders.
Mm-hmm. And Ron Elving, as usual, the president declined to be drawn on how he would respond to this debate as it's going on among the presidential candidates.
Yes, he said anything about presidential politics was not a subject he would get into, and he also said anything having to do with intelligence matters that came up would not be a subject that he would get into. One very crisp answer that he did give, Neil, when he was asked about the Red Cross report saying that detainees held by the United States had been in effect tortured, he said, haven't read it, we don't torture.
Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, with us here in Studio 3A. Our thanks as well to Lauren Jenkins, NPR senior foreign editor, with us in the studio as well. Stay tuned to NPR News for more coverage of the president's news conference throughout the day on newscasts and on programs like All Things Considered, coming up later today. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News.
And you've been listening to the special coverage on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good morning. It's coming up on 10:30, and now we'll join our first hour interview of Focus 580 in progress. A reminder that we had taken the initially scheduled first hour interview with May Barenbaum, professor of entomology at the University of Illinois, her regular visit to talk about insects and insect appreciation, and we moved it to the 11 o'clock hour this morning. So the interview that you would have heard in the 11 o'clock hour, an archive with Carlos Ayer, professor of history and religious studies at Yale University, about his book Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy. We now join that in progress.
Sad book. There's a fundamental note of sadness that I think pervades the whole thing. And I guess I wonder how you think about that, particularly the balancing the what seem to be pleasant childhood memories of a really a kind of a glowing, sun-drenched, childhood. You know, I think about you're right in the beginning of the book talking about what sunsets are like, mm-hmm. you know, about having that kind of image, balancing that all the good stuff against the unhappiness and the sadness and this sort of this fundamental sense that something is missing that's never quite going to be restored.
Yeah, well, the book is about loss, basically, and how to cope with loss and learning and how it is that at least I learned that every loss has gains that come along with it, that nothing is an undiluted loss, even the loss of a loved one. The past remains a world of its own, and as long as you have your memory and as long as these memories are crisp and clear, you never really lose the past, but you have this longing for it, especially in my case and the case of almost all Cubans my age who left as children. We cannot revisit physically our childhood. We can't go back to the houses where we grew up in. We can't walk the streets in the neighborhoods where we lived in. And the past becomes sort of encased as very much as an object inside a paperweight, you know, that you see floating inside the glass. It's there, but you can't get to it. And, of course, everyone loses their childhood. Absolutely everyone on earth loses their childhood, and they can't go back to it. But in the case of all the kids who left Cuba under the same circumstances as my brother and myself, it was a very abrupt end. Literally, overnight, we lost our childhood. So there is that sense of longing. But there's also a sense of hope. I would say that something like two-thirds or three-quarters of the mail that I receive, and I receive a lot of mail, people say, I read your book, and it made me laugh, and it made me cry. It's gotten to the point now where my wife says, did you get another one of those I laughed and I cried letters? I said, yes. Oh, it's okay. That's exactly the reaction I wanted to elicit from readers. This is how life is. It doesn't matter if you live through a revolution or not. Everyone's life has some sadness in it and a lot of loss. And all human beings on earth have to learn how to cope with this. A revolution makes it more intense, but I don't care where anyone lives or how rich they are. Everyone has to face up to the fact that life is a series of pluses and minuses, and one has to somehow go with the pluses rather than the minuses.
You haven't been back, not since you left.
No. I always thought it was too dangerous to go back. They could drum up charges against you. Mm-hmm. If I were to go to Cuba, they would not accept my American citizenship. As a matter of fact, the minute you land there, if you're an American citizen born who was born in Cuba, they take away your American passport and hold it hostage until the day that you leave. And instead, they make you pay some exorbitant amount, like $200, for a Cuban passport. I have met people my age who went back in the 80s and got in trouble. One man in particular I met just 2 months ago went with his mother and sister in the late 80s. The minute he stepped off the plane, they threw him in prison and accused him of espionage. They had photos of him standing outside the United Nations in New York protesting against the Castro regime. They had the photos. And they knew who he was. And the minute he stepped off the plane, they arrested him. Now I can't go back because my book is on the index of forbidden books. And they're actually searching luggage and confiscating any copies that they can find.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Carlos Ayer. He's professor of history and of religious studies at Yale University, where he got his PhD, and is the author of a memoir, Waiting for Snow in Havana. And it is out in paperback now. It's published by Free Press. Won the National Book Award in 2003 for nonfiction writing. And you might want to take a look at it. And questions, of course, do are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Why do you think your father decided to to stay. I'm assuming that there would have been a point where he could have left.
Yeah. It was too late, though. But one thing that I always keep in mind is I never, ever got to speak to my father as an adult. Mm-hmm. The last real conversation I had with him was the day I left when I was 11. He died in 1976. Up to that time, calls to Cuba were limited to 3 minutes, and there was always someone listening at the other end. Once, for instance, when my mom said to my dad, "I miss you so much," someone at the other end started laughing. So you had to be very careful what you said, and you only had 3 minutes. So I never got to ask my dad point blank, you know, "What are you doing? Why are you staying there? Why don't you come and join us?" I got hints in letters. He always kept saying, "This is going to change. You'll see. We'll be together soon. This can't last this long. This can't last too long." But then he developed heart disease and started to make arrangements to leave. But he died of a heart attack before he could leave, suddenly. That was that. That was the end of his effort to join us.
Your father's name is not Air. That's your mother's family's name.
That's right.
Why did you take your mother's family's name and not your father's?
Well, again, there are many reasons for that, and it's a very thick cultural context. As you probably know, most Hispanics use both family surnames. Mm-hmm. I grew up having two surnames. The minute I landed in the United States, I was very, very miffed. I was told, "No, per customer. You can only have one last name." So I went from being Carlos Nieto Eire to being Carlos Nieto. And it annoyed me greatly. I also, in the 1970s, after my father died, came to the realization that it was my mother who had shouldered most of the burden of trying to join us, being here for us, even though there was not much she could do for my brother and me when she arrived. She tried. And my father had not. So I decided to use her name. I never got rid of Nieto. I still have it as a middle initial. And as a matter of fact, in all my scholarly writing, people know me as Carlos M. N. Air. Mm-hmm. The Free Press didn't want me to use middle initials. So I said, fine. But there's also a very, very, very old Spanish custom which fell into disuse to the 18th century in Hispanic cultures. Individuals chose which of the two surnames to pass on to their children. And in the case of my father's family in the 17th century, the name Nieto, surname, was passed on through someone's mother. Otherwise, our name would have been Sanchez. So putting all these things together and also not being able to abide anyone calling me Nieto. I thought, maybe it's even more respectful of the name Nieto just to leave it as an initial than have someone call you Nieto all the time. Yeah. In Bloomington, everyone knew me as Charlie Nieto or Chuck Nieto.
Chuck Nieto.
Yeah. Yep, quite a difference. As soon as I got to Chicago, I went back to being Carlos rather than Charlie or Chuck.
I guess the reason I ask is just I was wondering or want to make sure that if people somehow get this idea that it was a disavowing of your dad that it wasn't anything like that.
Right. No, it wasn't. Although I guess in part it's very easy for people to make that assumption, and I know I live with that constantly because people ask, you know, what's the deal here?
Yeah.
And I just got a letter, an email this morning from someone who asked, aren't you being disrespectful to your dad for changing your name? So I have to write to him and say, I don't think so.
We have caller, and would welcome others. We do have about 20 minutes left in this part of the show. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Urbana on line 1. Hello. Yeah.
Hello. Hi. Uh-huh. Thank you for being on the show, and I really look forward to reading your book. I'm a Cuban American too, and I came in mid 60s, and we had the same situation with the name. Yeah. So I really relate there. And for me, the middle initial, of my mother's maiden name is very important. If it's left out, it's like, we had to switch the names around with the father keeping being the main name, and then we put it, or my mother's name as a middle initial. And whenever people leave it out, it's like, it's like a piece of my identity being stripped out. But I just want to ask a question about, the Cuban situation is very complex, and I think you kind of touched earlier in that, change was needed. And the revolution in the beginning under Castro, the hope was different than what culminated in the end. And that's what a lot of people, the majority of the Cubans did support the revolution, but when as it changed and, the relations with Soviet Union, et cetera, then that really changed the flavor of the revolution. And it was no longer just one of the Cuban people. But beyond that, I'm just wondering about, there are a lot of questions I want to ask you, but I was just wondering how you deal with those kinds of complexities of the Cuban history, and also within your own family, just the pain that I hear, the feelings of loss, not knowing, you remember certain things and you may not remember other things, and that obviously your own childhood was very painful, leaving your parents at such a young age with your brother. And I'm just wondering how you deal with those kinds of issues.
Well, in the book, I deal with it through narrative. I don't try to analyze things. I just simply state what I lived through.
Yeah.
And my view of things. Several reviewers have remarked that it's almost like saying it's too bad he came from that family. It would have been such a much better story if he had been poorer. As if I don't have a right to complain because we had more than some other Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
I try to focus on the complexity of things through narrative. I try to focus through the disappointment, or what in the book I point out is one of the most beautiful Spanish words, desengaño,
mm-hmm.
that everyone went through.
Right.
Because almost every time that I make a public appearance now, I get a question where I have to clarify. No, Fidel was not the only answer to Batista. Many of the men who landed at the Bay of Pigs invasion had fought against Batista. Mm-hmm. Many of them had actually fought side by side with Fidel, and were betrayed and were trying to reclaim the revolution. But those complexities are often lost on anyone who doesn't understand the intricacies of Cuban history in the 20th century.
Right.
They're sometimes lost on me because as a professional historian who doesn't deal with Cuba, I deal with Europe in the years 1400 to 1700. I know as a professional historian, there are many things that I should find out details before I speak about them. That's another reason in the book I didn't. The only fact I checked in writing this book was how many men landed at the Bay of Pigs.
Mm.
I wanted to have that number, but it's the only fact I looked up. Everything else I say in there was my impression. And a couple of writers, readers have written in to correct some of my facts.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all minor points, very minor points.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Other people who are listening, you have questions, you can call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think some people would look at you and your experience and say, here is a man who is the embodiment of one of our cherished, most cherished beliefs. They might actually use the term myth, that a person can come here to this country with little or nothing, mm-hmm. and can become a great success, can go on to get a PhD at Yale and become a college professor and win the National Book Award. I wonder how you think about that.
I think this is a marvelous country and a unique place on earth. And it is true. You can end up as I did, but many don't. It's not a guarantee for everyone who comes to this country that they might end up successful. In my case, luck had a lot to do with it, just sheer luck. When we moved to Chicago, if we had moved into a neighborhood that was 10 blocks south of where we ended up, I would have gone to a terrible high school. instead of going to a good high school. And what might have happened to me if I had gone to the awful high school, I don't want to know. But we almost moved there. And also the generosity of the American people, the generosity with which I witness all the time now from this end in higher education, the fact that there are so many scholarships, the fact that an education in this country is really never denied to anyone. Sure, you have to work hard and you have to make sacrifices, but no one is denied an education if they want it in this country. And quite often the neediest have even a better opportunity than those who are not so needy because there are so many fellowships and scholarships. I didn't have to pay any college tuition. I didn't have to pay any graduate school tuition. I had to take out a lot of loans, which I paid until 3 years ago. But no one stopped me. No one said, you can't do this. I picked one of the most impractical professions on earth, and I managed to luck out, too, to get a job and then get another good job and end up here. It took hard work, but it also has a certain amount of luck involved.
You were paying college loans until you were 50?
Yes. Yes, I got into a particularly bad loan I'd rather not discuss with these people. If I start to give you the details, everyone will think I'm probably the stupidest person on earth for having signed on the dotted line. Yeah, I paid a percentage of my income. I ended up paying something like a 3,000% interest when all was said and done.
Hmm. Well, it's paid off. Maybe that's all.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's behind me now, yeah.
Let's talk. We have somebody here calling on a mobile phone, cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Hope you can hear me in the middle of the monsoon season here in central Illinois, calling from the car. But very interesting story, fascinating. I'm 48 years old and actually grew up on the south side of Chicago, I think pretty close to the time you were down there. So It was interesting to hear you talk. My question, listening to you talk about Castro and the revolution, I can remember going through the late 60s and the 70s and the young people kind of putting their arms around Che at that point, making him a hero and the posters of him and so on and so forth, the kind of the counterculture. From your perspective, was he quite the hero that we made him out to be, or was he in fact part and parcel of the whole Fidel regime there?
This annoys me to no end every time I see Che's face on a T-shirt, because Che was a cold-blooded killer, a ruthless, ruthless man who put his ideology before any other human being. Anyone got in his way, that was it. He was competition for Fidel, though. Fidel has never liked having a number two person. And it's one of the reasons that Che ended up in Bolivia, was that Fidel was very glad to get rid of him. But he was not a good person by any definition of the term. Most of the people who wear his face on T-shirt would probably, if they lived under Che's rule, be in prison. That's the right. Great irony.
Well, it's very refreshing to hear you talk about that. And I'm just wondering, from your point of view, how do you think all of that, I mean, it was quite prevalent, if you remember in the 70s, and do you just think he was something that was kind of plucked out of the sky and the counterculture kind of put their arms around it? Or I mean, was there any, how do you think that all came to be like that?
Well, it came to be because, especially in the 60s and early 70s, the ideology which was at the heart of the Cuban Revolution was the ideology that most of the young people, especially the better educated people in the United States, embraced, which was total equality, sharing of the goods, trying to wipe out poverty, trying to help the underprivileged, trying to sort of level out society so that everyone would be on the same level. That was the aim of the revolution. But it was never achieved. That's the sad part. And the little that was achieved through such cruelty that's what most Americans and Europeans and even Latin Americans still don't understand. I was very, very happy to see in a catalog that my teenage son received, they were selling T-shirts, and the Che Guevara T-shirt was right in between one for Homer Simpson and another one for Megadeth. And
well,
I thought, this is the ultimate. This is where Che belongs, next to Homer Simpson, basically.
Everything comes around full circle. I'm not familiar with the story, but can you tell me the story behind how he died?
He went to Bolivia to incite revolution in Bolivia and ended up getting caught by the Bolivian army with help from the CIA, and he was killed. And actually, the most famous photo of Che, the one you see on T-shirts and mugs and so on, this is when he was in Bolivia, not from Cuba.
I see. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Let's go
to another caller here, someone in southeastern Illinois on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I was curious. You said that most of your father's income went into the art objects. I just wondered what happened to the art objects.
I don't know. When you left Cuba, you had to leave absolutely everything behind. I left with 2 changes of clothing. That's all you were allowed to take out. They actually strip searched you to make sure you weren't taking out any valuables. When my father died, he was in the process of actually trying to establish a museum. But I don't know what happened after he died. I have no idea. All of it is gone. And in Cuba, you can't have any you don't have any property. Everything belongs to, quote unquote, the people.
So they left them with him until his death then. I mean, they didn't confiscate them immediately.
No, usually they wouldn't come in and confiscate what you had inside the house that you were living. They could come and take your house away and give you another one if they thought that your house was too big for you. But no, they generally didn't come and take things away from you right under your feet. But when you left, you had to leave absolutely everything behind.
Thank you.
And they inventoried everything, too, to make sure that everything was there on the day that you left.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Carlos Eyre about his book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy, about his growing up in Cuba in the 50s, about how he came to the United States, won the National Book Award last year. It's now available in a paperback published by Free Press. I wonder how you would react to what I'm sure would be the position of the Cuban government and perhaps some of its supporters, that if Cubans now are worse off than they were before Castro, it is not his fault. It's not fault of socialism. It's basically because a state of war exists between it's not official, but a state of war exists between mm-hmm. Cuba and the United States, and it's because of persecution, essentially by the United States that Cubans are poor today.
I had to laugh when I went to speak at the University of Wisconsin. I was supposed to be sponsored by some Latin American council or something, but they pulled away the sponsorship and said that they couldn't sponsor me because I was coming to represent the oppression of the Cuban people by the exile community. And I laughed and laughed at that one. The claim being made by Castro and people who don't know any better that the embargo has caused this is a bold-faced lie, and it's a stupid lie, too, which is very easy to uncover. Cuba can trade with the rest of the world. Cuba can get whatever goods it wants from the rest of the world, and the United States is only one of several countries in the world that produces goods. The problem is that the economy in Cuba is totally centralized and totally under the control of the government. There is no room for private enterprise whatsoever. And this is what has caused the country to decline as precipitously as it has. This is why there's no paint for the buildings. This is why there are no timbers, why there are no steel rods. This is why all the buildings are falling down and why people are starving to death very slowly, is that everything is very tightly controlled in Cuba. So therefore, the economy has collapsed. And they can't trade with the rest of the world because they have crashed their own economy, not because of the embargo. You don't have to take an economics course to figure this one out. Canada has been trading with Cuba nonstop since 1959. Cuba had access to all the same goods that Canadians have. But the government there chose to sort of stifle and strangle any initiative that is not part of the central planning. And that creates chaos. It creates instability. And when something goes wrong, it goes wrong and on a very large scale, because most of the programs focus on creating one type of income. Like, for instance, for many, many years, Fidel was hell-bent on having these massive amounts of sugar produced and that this was going to get the economy going. But, of course, failure after failure just drove the sugar economy of Cuba further down the tubes. And without help from the Soviet Union after 1991, forget it. There's no way that they could pick up the pieces.
Did you ever – I know I've read and you've talked about the fact that you lived in Bloomington, Illinois, and you lived in Chicago, and then and once you got into your academic career, you were in Minnesota, and now you're in – is it New Haven? Where
New Haven, yes. Is? Yeah.
And that in a lot of those places, there weren't a lot of other Cubans, so maybe you didn't have an opportunity to really get into any sort of a local Cuban community. I guess – I wonder, did you ever – and we're coming down here, I don't have a whole lot of time, but did you ever think about involving yourself in politics on that issue, that is, the relationship between Cuba and the United States?
No, not really. What happened to me is very common among people my age who were scattered, who were taken out of the South Florida Cuban community. I thought what had happened to me was more or less like a bad accident. I had to accept it and move on and do something else. The sweetest irony of all is that, of course, I buried all this. I thought I had put it behind me, but I hadn't. It came bubbling up when I wrote this book. And now I'm not deeply involved in the politics, but I find myself drawn to it constantly. Every time I make a public appearance, I feel I have to speak out. And I think it's also one of the privileges that come with age. When you're 53, you care less about people's feelings. If somebody says something to me that is I know to be patently wrong, before I used to remain silent and just say, well, fine, it's none of my business. But now I correct people all the time, and I'm happy about it. But I don't have the time to devote to crusading on any level.
Well, we've come to the end of the time, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the book. I think it's really beautifully written, so I appreciate
thank you.
The time. Our guest,
thank
Carlos
you.
Ayer, he's professor of history and religious studies at Yale, and the book is titled Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy. It is now available in paperback from the Free Press. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to wyll.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com. Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson. For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson's team of experts and strategic consulting approach utilize the latest technology. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart.com.